Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
It's been called the all-American comfort food. And whether you like it creamy or crunchy, we'll be talking about peanut butter on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, and indeed, peanut butter. Who hasn't had a peanut butter sandwich or a peanut butter and jelly sandwich at some point during the, or just a scoop of peanut butter out of the jar at some point in their lives, unless, unfortunately, you have a peanut allergy. But peanut butter is more than just a spread for a sandwich. It has been called everything from a therapeutic food to a health substitute to a protein substitute. And it has been around for a long time. A lot of myths surrounding the origins of peanut butter. But we have someone with us today who can put to rest all of those false stories. And that's John Krampner. John is the author of the new book called Creamy and Crunchy, An Informal History of Peanut Butter, the All-American Food. Welcome, John.
Good morning, Linda.
It's interesting because everyone thinks they know the origins of peanut butter and who started it. And, of course, we know that a little bit of research and what brands came first. I have to tell you, I was so surprised in reading your book about some of the background of peanut butter. And, of course, peanuts and peanut butter or peanut ground peanuts have been around in different parts of the world for a long time. Tell us a little bit about, let's go back to the peanut a little bit and tell us a little bit, just a little bit about where they come from and how we got to where we are.
Certainly. Peanuts are native to the eastern foothills of the Bolivian Andes, the cultivated peanut. And so they've been found in archaeological sites going back almost 4,000 years in that area, and it's only because it's such a tropical area that they probably don't have earlier records. But the Incas were really the first people to grind peanuts into a paste-like substance, and as a matter of fact, some archaeologists have, at some excavations, have said there are so many peanut shells scattered around that these old Inca sites look like poorly swept baseball stadiums. The Spanish and Portuguese explorers took peanuts around the world, and as part of that, on their voyages back to Europe, they stopped off in Africa and dropped some off there. And the areas of Africa where they dropped them off, which roughly correspond to the old French West Africa, also happened to be the primary slave trading areas. And really, that's how peanuts got to the United States, are in the hold of slave ships.
Hmm, indeed. Well, so peanuts were around, I mean, and they're not the easiest thing to grow and cultivate.
No, absolutely not. The actually, one of the interesting things about the peanut plant is that it produces a kind of almost an orchid-like looking yellow-orangey flower above ground. It dies after about a day or two, and then burrows underground where it produces the peanut. So the peanut plant is one of very few plants in the food world that flowers above ground but fruits below ground. But you're absolutely right. They can be very difficult to grow. And traditionally, there was a lot of, prior to mechanization, there was just a lot of hand labor involved in digging them up, tying them to stack poles in the field, dragging them over to stationary peanut pickers. And it's only with the advent of several generations of improved farm equipment that they really could become a major commercial crop.
Well, and a commercial crop they did. I mean, peanut butter can be found probably in just about every American home, and then across Europe and other places as well. That's saying a lot for a growth of a crop. Let's talk about the beginnings of peanut butter and who's credited. I mean, most people associate George Washington Carver with the peanut and peanut butter, but goes back further than that.
Well, absolutely, and as a matter of fact, since you mentioned George Washington Carver, I was really astonished as I was researching the book to find out that not only did he not invent peanut butter, as William F. Buckley Jr. Once wrote in National Review that he did, but oddly, he wasn't even that knowledgeable about peanuts, and I feel somewhat sacrilegious saying that, but I read his pamphlet about 105 ways of preparing the peanut for human consumption, and he writes, for example, that it was that the peanuts grow best in clay soil, which, I mean, is simply not true. They grow best in a sandy loam soil. The two schools of thought, and there's still a controversy to this day about who deserves the credit for inventing peanut butter. Some people say it's John Harvey Kellogg of the cereal dynasty. He took out a patent on a peanut butter-like substance in 1895, but I read that patent, and it calls for boiling peanuts, and I don't know if you've ever had boiled peanuts.
I have, Virginia boiled peanuts, indeed.
it's really nothing like the feel or the flavor of roasted peanuts, which is the flavor of peanut butter. The other person who's given credit is a St. Louis snack food manufacturer named George Bale, B-A-Y-L-E, who claims to have started selling peanut butter in 1894, a year before the patent. And I did dive into library stacks and interview people, and I still haven't quite sorted it out myself, so the controversy is ongoing.
Well, you said by the time you spoke to, and I noticed in your book, by the time you spoke to his great-granddaughter or somebody, that you knew more about him than she did. So I guess you've done a little research.
I've tried my best.
Well, whether it was Bale or it was Kellogg, I mean, indeed, this product took off. Well, Kellogg, of course, as we know, was running a sanatorium, and he had made all kinds of health claims about, you know, chewing and different food substitutes, certainly vegetarian substitutes. And peanut butter in its true form is indeed a very healthy food. It's high in calories, so it's good for people who need nourishment, high in calories and fat, but it is a good meat substitute.
Oh, absolutely. It's very high in protein, and so that makes it very popular with vegetarians as a protein source. And as a matter of fact, one of the earliest peanut butters, which dates to the late 19th century, was Dr. Schindler's peanut butter, which was made by, it was, I believe, called the Vegetarian Food and Nut Company. It was based in Baltimore and Washington, D.C., and actually their D.C. Plant was very close to where the Washington Nationals baseball stadium is today. But the Schindler's brand was around for quite a while. It still existed in the 1950s, and as a matter of fact, one of the kind of interesting things that I came across about it is a live on-air commercial was done on one of the Washington TV stations in the 1950s by that station's weatherman by the name of Willard Scott, who, of course, went on to be on the Today Show. And he was working on that commercial with Jim Henson and an early form of the Muppets. And what Scott would do in that commercial was feed a spoonful of Dr. Schindler's to Kermit the Frog, who would go, ah.
Which, if he had just had a spoonful of peanut butter, probably wouldn't
Absolutely.
Be able to go, ah, but... You'd kind of get his have his tongue stuck to his palate.
But, it was the television equivalent of poetic license.
And that was as late. That was Schindler's lasted then as late as the 50s. You're saying?
Yes.
Huh. Interesting. Or to say otherwise, Henson and was on as early as the 50s. Well, that was very
interesting.
I was
a little surprised at that myself.
Yeah. Must have been a student at that time, I suppose. Well, there are so many early types of peanut butter and so many early brands of peanut butter. We can talk more about those. But which, as far as what goes into peanut butter, as you stated quite succinctly, first of all, it's not a nut and it's not butter, right? So,
absolutely not. The peanut is a legume. True nuts... like walnuts and almonds have hard shells and they grow on trees, but botanically peanuts have more in common with alfalfa, clover, peas, beans, lentils, mesquite, and even carob.
And it's known by lots of different names. You quote and use Andy Smith a great deal in your book for some of his research, and he's a good friend of ours, been on the show many times, and he did his wonderful book on peanuts, the illustrious goober pea. But goober, we do hear goober, thinking of the chocolate, you know, peanuts a lot. But that, you say that possibly comes from the African word?
Oh, absolutely. The word goober comes from the word nguba, N-G-U-B-A.
Mm-hmm.
From a, I believe that's from the Congo language in Central West Africa, and it's one of the few words in English that has an African root. And another one, interestingly, is apparently in South Carolina, peanuts are also known as pinders, P-I-N-D-A-R. Which comes from another African language, Mpinda. And so peanuts and are responsible for two of the few words in English that have African-based roots.
Hmm. Well, what are there many different varieties of peanuts? And if so, which varieties are used in peanut butter?
That's a really interesting question. There are four main kinds of peanuts grown in the United States. There are runners, which are the main peanut used in peanut butter these days. And quite honestly, of the four major kinds, most peanut aficionados feel that they're really the least flavorful, although there have been some advances made through hybrids in recent years, in recent decades. Then you get Spanish peanuts, which are kind of the smallest and roundest and tend to have the highest oil content. You have Virginias, which are the largest peanuts, and those are the ones that when you buy in-shell peanuts in the stores, those are usually Virginias.
Mm.
Then you get Valencias, which are kind of a real... they're much smaller percent. They're only about 1 or 2% of the peanut crop. They're grown mainly in southeastern New Mexico and the adjoining counties of the Texas Panhandle. Now, interestingly, from peanut butter's birth in the 1890s up until about 1970 or so, peanut butter was usually made out of a combination of Spanish and Virginia peanut. But then starting around 1970, a new runner hybrid called the Flow Runner was developed down at the University of Florida, and it tended to taste a bit better, and it was very prolific, and so peanut butter manufacturers switched over to it, and most stabilized peanut butter today is made with runner peanut. But what's interesting from my point of view is when I was growing up, the peanut butter that I ate was mostly a combination of Spanish and Virginia's. Mm. When I went away to college about 1970, I stopped eating peanut butter for a while, just since that was pretty much all I ate growing up, and I thought I might as well see if there was anything else in the world. And about 10 years later, when I started eating peanut butter again, I thought, seems to me that it tastes a little different. And I thought, well, maybe I'm just being like a rank sentimentalist, but by God, I was right.
Huh, interesting. And so today it's the, they're not using the Flow Runners. What are they using today mostly in most peanut butters today?
Well, they are using descendants of the Flow Runners. The Flow Runner was around for about, let's say, 10 or 15 years, and then it just developed disease problems as a result of being grown in monoculture. Hmm. But most of the peanuts used in peanut butter today are essentially descendants of the Flow Runner.
Well, you had mentioned something about oil, and so that, and I just jotted that down quickly because I did want to talk about that. In the early days of production, of course, they were, you know, we're talking small batch peanut butters, right? So the oil would separate, as we now see when we're back to our natural peanut butters.
Yes.
So you talked about some changes that happened in the manufacturing of peanut butter, and you mentioned five major changes. What were those five major changes?
Absolutely. First one, which we've already gone over, is the fact that peanut butter today is made mostly with runners instead of Spanish and Virginia peanuts, as it originally was. Secondly, peanut butter is mostly stabilized today. Back in the 1890s, it was all natural or old-fashioned, of course. And I would say about 90% of the peanut butter market today is stabilized, and about 10% is natural.
Stabilized meaning that it's hydrogenated?
Either hydrogenated or that it's stabilized using palm oil, which is a very bad thing for reasons we can go into if
right.
you like. And either hydrogenated or using palm oil to prevent the oil separation in the peanut butter. A third difference in peanut butter is that originally... there was no crunchy peanut butter. That was first test marketed by Skippy in Salt Lake City in 1935, but for the first 40 years or so of peanut butter, there was no crunchy. There was, however, another texture, which for the most part no longer exists, which was coarse or grainy, as the name implies, it wasn't. It didn't have chunks in it. It wasn't smooth. It was kind of had kind of a granular texture, and I think the reason that was done is with the coarser grainy, you didn't have the extensive degree of oil separation that you would have with creamy peanut butter back then. And remember, refrigerators didn't become common household items until about the 1920s
That's
or so.
Right.
And so you would have the peanut butter in not being refrigerated, it could go stale pretty quickly. And so coarse and grainy was a way of moderating the oil separation. Two other key differences. One is originally, peanut butter was, it either came in tins or was just like ladled out of, you know, barrels, really.
Like a big vat in a general store?
Exactly. And, you know, while researching the book, I came across these really nostalgic articles by old men who, you know, recalled going into the local general store and just smelling the peanut butter drifting out of the vat, you know. And so the barrels gave way to tins. Then during World War II, you know, tin and metal was needed for the war effort. So then the switch was made to glass jars, although a couple of what you would call, I guess, kind of better brands used glass jars going further back, but it wasn't really common until post-World War II. And then in the late 1980s, when they developed plastics that didn't allow for too much air getting in, then there was a switch to plastic jars, which is what most, although not all, peanut butters come in now. And again, finally, because peanut butter is stabilized or hydrogenated now, most of it, it can be distributed nationally and internationally. Originally, peanut butter was just was made locally or regionally. And as a matter of fact, you know, now we just have like a handful of peanut butter plants in the country. But back in the early 20th century, almost any city of size had its own peanut butter factory. There were several in the San Francisco Bay Area.
So it was a local product then, basically.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, we are going to talk more about some of the brands that are out and about there, and some of the battles that went on when we come back after a short break.
Ring the alarm and don't look back. Just a fool's on the map. Just a fool's on the map.
You're listening to Wilderness Trips by Cookies on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
And welcome back. You are listening to A Taste of the Past here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. And I'm talking with John Krampner, the author of Creamy and Crunchy, A History of Peanut Butter. And as I like to say on this on my show often, everything old is new again. And indeed, with peanut butter, there's a reason for a lot of that. But we are seeing now a return to natural peanut butter, or, you know, with no additives, no stabilizers, just good old ground peanuts. Well, John, you mentioned one of those reasons, and that being refrigeration. Why do you think there is this great return to the old-fashioned kind of peanut butter?
I think it's part of a broader trend of Americans just wanting to eat in a more healthy and natural way and reject the some of the unhealthy corporate foods that can be foisted upon them.
Well, you did mention the additives during the stabilization era when, you know, said, hey, this is great, we can give it a shelf life like Twinkies of, you know, forever. go buy Twinkies. And of course, that palm oil being one of the stable hydrogenized oils added. And yes, that gave peanut butter a bad rap, and people were shying away from it as not a healthy food. The too much and a lot of sugar added, and too much salt added. So where do we go with that? What do you think about the this? Is it all a bad thing, or have they tried to maintain a higher percentage of natural peanuts?
Well, the basically the over the last 30 or 40 years, the percentage of peanut butter, which is now natural or old-fashioned, has come up from what I believe was about maybe as little as 2 or 3% back around 1970 to today it's about 10%. And the pioneer of that movement was a man named Frank Ford, who created Deaf Smith peanut butter, which is a kind of a legendary among foodies. It was the he was a veteran of I believe, let's see if he was, I don't know if he was Vietnam or, but anyway, he was a veteran. He's very religious. He's active in Campus Crusade for Christ. He's had a crew cut. But nonetheless, he was very keen on whole and natural foods, and so he came up with this Deaf Smith peanut butter, and it was the first peanut butter to use Valencia's. It was the first that was organic, and again, he was this interest. It now, by the way, today it's still, in a sense, exists. It's not called Deaf Smith anymore, but after a few changes, it's still around as Arrowhead Mills Creamy Organic, which, which sadly has been caught up in the Sunland Salmonella contamination, the Sunland plant down in Portales, New Mexico. But Ford was just a really just cranky, colorful, wonderful, irascible character, and so on one hand, you know, here he was, you know, the veteran, the active Christian, the crew cut guy. On the other hand, he was natural foods, and he ended one of our interviews by telling me to keep on trucking.
That's great. You mentioned actually in your introduction to your book that you were used to writing biographies. You thought this was going to be, you know, a walk in the park, and then you realized writing food history was not was not as easy as one thought. And you indeed have covered a lot of ground in this book. One thing you do sprinkle throughout, which I love, are different recipes and, of course, anecdotes about people's favorite sandwiches. And we all know some of the stories, you know, especially Elvis Presley's story of his sandwich. I was surprised to learn that even Hemingway wrote about peanut butter in a sandwich. What, to you, was one of the more or most unusual peanut butter recipes, be it a sandwich or other dish?
Well, to be honest with you, I can't really point to one, because I was just astonished at the versatility of peanut butter. There must be almost no human food that it hasn't been combined with at one time or another. And actually, my mother recently reminded me, when I presented her with a copy of the book, that when I was a little boy, and I'm sort of embarrassed to admit this to your listener, but listeners, I put peanut butter on spaghetti, and it's like that just, that should probably be in the penal code somewhere.
But you think of it, Chinese and Southeast Asians have noodles with peanut sauce. That's quite common, actually.
Well, actually, and now that you mention it, you know, satay sauce is very popular in Southeast Asia.
Right.
And as a result of that, because and Indonesia was a Dutch colony for a long time, and probably as a result of that, the Dutch are one of two people around the world or two countries, which on a per capita basis eat more peanut butter than Americans. And I think that's because of their custom in having satay sauce from their Indonesian colony.
Right. Yeah.
And the other country, by the way, is Canada.
Hmm. Well, here in America, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, we think of peanut butter, and of course, what comes to mind are the big guys, you know, Jif and Skippy and
Peter Pan.
Peter Pan, yes. But I was, and then surprised to learn in 1914. Well, then you just explained it because it was a local, kind of local regional product, but that there were 25 brands, actual brands on the market, and that surprised me. Another thing that surprised me was that the first national brand to make peanut butter was none other than
it was actually the baby food company.
Right. Beechnut,
absolutely, and they made it from they started making it in 1904. They made it up to, until 1956 when they merged with Lifesavers, another early brand which surprised me also was Heinz. The ketchup people.
Right.
They made it from 1909 through 1950. And kind of an interesting sidelight about Heinz is that it was the first brand of peanut butter to be hydrogenated. When I started doing researching for the book, everyone said, oh, Peter Pan was the first. Well, Peter Pan came on the market in 1928. And even if you include some of its precursors made by Swift, which was for a long time the manufacturer of Peter Pan, then it goes back to 1924 or 25. But Heinz was stabilized by hydrogenation starting in 1923. So they went the blue ribbon for that.
Yeah. Yes. Well, you know, there's a lot of talk today about American food and what is American food. And, of course, you can't get any more American than peanut butter. And is there such a thing as regional food is a big question. Well, in fact, you pointed out that there are regional differences in America in taste, how tastes run to peanut butter.
Oh, absolutely. The in the South, they tend to like peanut butter very sweet. In the Midwest, which on a per capita basis is where peanut butter is the most popular in the U.S., they tend to like it a bit more on the salty or savory side. In New England, they like it sweet, but not as sweet as in the South. And out here on the West Coast, where I am, is really kind of the central for natural or old-fashioned peanut butter. So, yeah, I was a little surprised to learn that.
All right, interesting. Well, you know, it has fed the troops during wartime, and it had feeds people in crisis when there's a disaster. In fact, it was mentioned in the news quite a bit out here in the East Coast. We, you know, suffered Hurricane Sandy, and tens of thousands, I would venture to say hundreds of thousands of peanut butter sandwiches were made to feed so many people. Well, there was no power. There was no refrigeration. Food was lost and spoiled, but peanut butter was there on the shelves. And, of course, it flew off the shelves.
Absolutely. And, again, it both worked as, you know, something that does spoil, especially if it's stabilized, something that's very nutritious. And, of course, it's a comfort food. And so in times of stress like that, it fills the bill in that regard as well.
Right. And one of those products that had such a meteoric rise, I mean, from going from, you know, small production to being everywhere in a very short period of time. So it's quite amazing. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, John. And I, every time I open the book, I learn another fact that, you know, surprises me. And it all boils down to, not boiled, but roasted peanut butter.
Roasted.
Right, well, roasted peanuts.
It's very much an honor to be on. Thank you very much.
Well, so next time you reach for that jar of whatever brand you like, or go and grind your own at your local health food store. Just think about it. Creamy or Crunchy by John Krampner. This has been Linda Palacio on A Taste of the Past, and please join us again here on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.